this paper a couple months ago with Mark about how some simple models could maybe have an explanation in them for some of the anomalies that are showing up in deep release data. And it also sets up Jim's talk later in the day. So this work, all this, is coming at TV scale physics, which we hope our colleagues will find new physics, the TV scale. And it's coming at that scale from a different direction than usual motivation. So let's talk for a second about motivation. So the one thing I think we can all agree on is that guy's well motivated. After that, we're all going to start to disagree. And that's fine. I think we need to have as many approaches to TV scale physics as possible. We need to come up with all sorts of signatures and bug our experimental colleagues to look for them. And that's good. But this is coming at TV scale physics, not directly from the hierarchy problem, but from a different direction. So let me motivate that for a minute. So what is your beyond ceremonial motivation? What is my beyond ceremonial motivation for this work? Well, many of us think that that Lagrangian, the top of that slide, might actually be there in reality. And it has a problem in that it has a relevant operator, the Higgs mass, dimension 2. And the mass scale in front of that is a puzzle because it should be very high. It should be the cutoff scale of the theory. It shouldn't necessarily be a small scale. And even if you just do perturbative corrections within the standard model, you find a problem, a well-known problem of the hierarchy problem. So the name of the game, for the most part, and it's an excellent motivation to do this, is to figure out some symmetry that controls those radiative corrections to that mass term and work out what that symmetry predicts for other states x that come along with that Lagrangian, and then talk to our experimental colleagues about how to find x. That's all good. So usually what people do is start at the top of the list and work down, and there's nothing wrong with that. So maybe you don't want to solve the hierarchy problem, or maybe you just want to solve another compelling problem, but usually you work down the list, and usually you arrive at C, and then trouble happens. You check precision tests, or you just think about it more and more carefully, and you find an issue, and then you proceed back to A. And ideally, you'll know it's E because it'll pass D. And as people were saying this morning, the discovery reach of the machine is a couple of TeV, at least for many, many years. That's the way it is. So you need to be very aware that we already know things about physics of that energy, that mass scale. So because I'm coming at TV scale physics from a different direction, I better have a damn good motivation, better than the shark, maybe not, but at least a good motivation, a solid motivation of how I'm going to start and how I'm going to approach things. So I think it's good to start with what we experimentally know, and these are things that we actually know about TV scale physics at this point. So what we know is that we can look for it indirectly. We can look for the effect of these dimension six operators and all sorts of observables in flavor physics, for example. These are not all the ways we can indirectly look for new physics, but is a good list from this review by Perez, collaborator. And what we know is that the standard model contribution to, say, some meson mixing has a very peculiar form, which is dictated by the symmetry breaking structure, the flavor symmetry breaking structure of the standard model. So it's loop suppressed, first of all, and it's also importantly CKM suppressed. And then there's actually the Jim mechanism involved as well, is what we see. That's actually a little bit of an IR enhancement so that we can actually see it. If the Jim mechanism was exact, we wouldn't see anything. But it's a very peculiar form, this amplitude, and it's very small, and it agrees very well with experiment. So much so that you can find bounds on dimension six operators you can write down. So whatever your new physics is, if it induces these operators, you can find bounds on the Wilson coefficient divided by the mass scale of new physics. So if you fix your mass scale of new physics to be a TV, you find these very, very scary small numbers for the Wilson coefficient. Or if you say the Wilson coefficient is order one, then you find the bound on the mass scale of new physics lambda given there. So those are hundreds, tens, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of TV, depending on what you're looking at. And that is way beyond the discovery reach of LHC. So it's a fairly obvious but fairly important point that anything we find will be consistent with these strong flavor constraints. And that, I think that means it will have a non-generic symmetry structure. So the point is that, as I said, this amplitude in the standard model has this peculiar form. It has CKM suppression, and the pattern works for the standard model. So we want new physics to be a subdominant correction to that pattern. And that can happen because the mass scale is high, but we also, if we want the mass, we want these physics to be discoverable, we also want things like the CKM suppression of those amplitudes to also exist in these Wilson coefficients. So discoverable things are of interest, of course, to the experimentalist. So that's where I'm going to start. I'm going to start as this, because it's a solid piece of information that we already know. If you have a solid point, you can start from there and work yourself out. So I want some sort of symmetry, because we're in quantum field theory, we want some sort of symmetry that's going to dictate that this works, that this makes sense. It's not just some random thing. And there's a very nice, simple symmetry explanation for this if there is new physics beyond the standard model. And that's minimal flare violation. So minimal flare violation does exactly what you want in like the dumbest, most direct, simple way. You want the symmetry-breaking pattern of the flavor sector that's in the standard model to be replicated in some new physics sector so that those contributions to those dimension six operators are going to be subdominant to the standard model. And that will allow the mass scale of new physics to be low enough for our colleagues to discover, which is of interest. So the flavor structure of the standard model is this giant U3 to the fifth symmetry from all the rotations in the left and right-handed fields in the standard model. And the way you can think about this, just from a functional point of view, is you want to replicate the symmetry-breaking pattern in the new physics sector. And so you write down both standard model plus new physics theories that are invariant under this giant U3 to the fifth. And then you do that by basically promoting these Yukawa-Zasperian fields that have transformations under the flavor group. And then those Yukawas get BEVs, which breaks the symmetry down in the pattern that you know it does in the standard model. And then because you've restored the full flavor group, and then the breaking only comes from the Yukawas, the new physics sector also has the symmetry breaking structure that you know you need with respect to those precision tests. So that, at the end of the day, gives you new physics with the same symmetry breaking pattern as the flavor sector of the standard model, which allows mass scales to be low enough to allow discovery at LHC from a symmetry reason, not just from tuning some parameters or doing some sort of epistolic model building where you know get rid of things by hand. So you can have a trivial implementation. So one way there could be new physics, of course, which is uninteresting to us in this room, I think, is that just the mass scale is so high that, you know, those flavor measurements haven't found it because it's just not there, and LHC won't find it either. You could also have a trivial implementation of minimal flare violation where you have no flavor structure in new physics whatsoever. You can just say, look, it doesn't do any flavor change, it knows nothing about flavor. That's just the way it is. That could be the case. That's not terribly interesting to me. So what I've been doing recently is looking at a non-trivial implementation of this where we explore TV scale new physics that has non-trivial flavor representation, non-trivial flavor structure that corresponds to minimal flavor violation. So really what I'm doing is I'm starting in the middle of this list and working out. And we're not up to A, we're not down to E, but it is interesting that it's a different way to come at things, and I think it's a decent piece of motivation starting from experiment. So, I mean, we really don't know much about minimal flare violating field content when we do this. We're just really starting to do this sort of program and sort out what this could look like. There could be a whole sector there, and that flavor physics wouldn't pick it up, and there could be a whole minimal flare violating sector, and we don't really know what it would look like. What is its profile phenomenologically? What can we even write down as a starting point? It's kind of interesting. So let's start with some simple examples and couple it to the standard model and have it preserve minimal flare violation, and let's just see what we can actually write down. But, you know, you might be dismayed that I'm not solving the hierarchy problem. That's okay. I'm not saying you shouldn't solve the hierarchy problem. I'm just saying we should come at TV scale new physics in every way we can, and I think this is a perfectly valid way, motivated out of flavor physics. And here's, you know, examples of physics that doesn't solve the hierarchy problem. So maybe there's a little more of it. So if you're dismayed that I'm not solving the hierarchy problem, you'll be really dismayed at this slide. There's going to be lots of scalars. Let me just quickly remind you of this story. I think most people in the audience have seen this at one point or another. So let's start with the simplest case, spin zero, and see what we can write down that couples to the standard model that is dictated by this symmetry. So then we'll be consistent with flavor constraints. So the simplest one to write down was written down long ago. It's the Higgs. That works well. That has minimal flare violation. And then Mark and Anish wrote a paper a couple years ago pointing out that this octet scalar doublet also does the job. I got very interested in that. And the reason I got so interested in that was because it's a new way of coming at TV scale physics, and it's its new way of the symmetry telling you what to look for, which is very interesting. It has some nice features in the fact that it has color, so it has large production rates, and it can be light. We found after exhaustively trying to make it rule it out that it can really be light. These are nice features, but the real reason it's interesting is because of this new way of thinking about things with minimal flare violation and doing minimal flare violation model building. So we went on, and I wrote a paper with Mark, one of his students, Arnold and Maxine, last year on what else you can write down that's coupled to these bilinears. And this is it. This is what you can write down without inserting a Yukawa matrix. These are the non-trivial representations of the scalar in the flavor group, your SU3, your SU2, and your U1, as usual. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, it's not that long a list. The top of the list is actually pretty good shape with respect to proton decay, where a number conservation from gauge symmetry follows. Yep. Well, you'll have a general 2 Higgs scalar potential that will be there. But they're not driving electric symmetry or anything, so anything like that. I mean, they're coupled to the Higgs, but they're not giving you electric symmetry. Okay. So, where was that? Oh, yeah, so I'm just reminding you of this. Let me move on quickly. There are some issues here with some of these that carry a baryon number. Gauge symmetries protect the ones with green check marks alone, so they don't let the proton decay. And then the red check marks are when you also need lepton minimal flare violation to protect the proton for these to be around. So anyways, the only reason I'm reminding you of this is because I was imploring people in this room last year saying, look, you guys can do this with your digit data. You can discover these things or you can bound them in the first year. And there's digit search experts in the audience. So let me just implore you again. This is simple to do, and it's actually been started to be done by theorists. Han and collaborators looked at this, where they, you know, all they do is they just integrate these things out, look at the dimension six operators they induce, and they just put simple bounds in it from your digit data. You guys are going to be doing this, so I would ask you again to try and do a direct study on these. Simple to do. It's just a matter of group theory to work out what the Wilson coefficient is. They didn't actually do exactly these ones that are minimal flare violating safe, but this gives you an idea of what the mass bounds are going to be. Even from the data from CMS and Atlas that was just published this fall, they're already about 2 TeV. But it still needs a dedicated study. So you guys do it the best. So now let me go on and talk about vector quarks. So that's the spin zero case. There's not that much that you can write down, actually. And then what about spin one half? So the simplest version of spin one half we heard this morning about vector quarks a little bit is if you have these SU2 singlets fermions, you could have new matter content like that. You can motivate it in lots of models. So I could say words like E6 compactifications have vector quarks. They do. I don't know if you care, but they do. Say little Higgs models, you know, the T prime and little Higgs models that has such an important job to cancel off the top loop. That's a vector quark. Vector quarks exist in supersymmetry a lot. Anyways, they're around from top-down model building as well, but we're just going bottom-up, and we're going to see what we can write down when we just have simple vector quarks that are our choices to just look at the case where there are triplets in the flavor group, and we're going to look at both down vector quarks and up vector quarks. Down and up vector quarks, I mean, they have the same quantum numbers as the up and down quarks in the standard model, so they can mix with them. So that's your Lagrangian. VL and V-right are the left and right-handed components of the vector quarks. So it has a bare mass term, that kappa 2 coupling is there. That's its vector-like nature. And you also can write down the mixing term of the standard model, and you write down the Higgs coupling term. And that's what you got with the simple Lagrangian. And these are the models that you can write down that are consistent with minimal flare violation. There's not that many, again. And it turns out that minimal flare violation alone, I might have given you the impression that if you have minimal flare violation, you're golden. Everything's fine. Everything's going to work phenomenologically. That's not actually the case. And that's, so what you can actually write down in, and have in this minimal flare violating sector, if it were to exist, is actually even more constrained. So let me give you an example as to why that is. So this is the only one I'll end up at the end of the day saying is flavor natural. By flavor natural, what I mean by that is a Glashow-Weinberg naturalness criterion. So I want the thing to work because of the symmetry structure and group theory of the theory, not just because I'm choosing parameters. I want the symmetry structure to dictate that it works and is consistent with the phenomenological constraint. And that one, and one model just like that in the up quark sector are the only ones that work. Let me talk about that a little bit. So I'm really only going to talk about the down This is the down case, and the up case goes exactly the same way. There's five models. You know, instead of it being a three in the down, it's a three in the up. And it goes along exactly the same way, and there's only one model. It's just like that model, but in the up sector that works. So for example, what could go wrong? Even if you have minimal flare violation, this model, if you work out its mass spectrum, actually predicts that you would have non-hierarchical standard model quark masses, just due to mixing. So that would require tuning to make that actually be consistent with experiments. So that's a way that this is still unnatural, even though you have minimal flare violation. So the program here is to kind of write down all the field content you can, consistent with minimal flare violation, then take a hard look at the pheno and get down to an even smaller list that actually can work and actually be maybe sitting around the TV scale and part of a sector. The other ones are actually going to be bad because basically the mixing of them with standard model quark induces large shifts in the W and Z coupling to the standard model quarks that are problematic. At the end of the day, phenomenologically, that's the reason that they don't work well. And this one has zero here for this coupling because this right-handed guy has the same gauge and flavor quantum numbers as the standard model right-handed triplet. Down quarks, and so you can go to a position in flavor space, in the space of those two fields where you set that coupling to zero. So it's predictive, it's a symmetry, you know it's going to be predictive, but let me just talk a little bit about the guts of how it works out to be predictive. So imagine the case where you take the vector quark's mass to infinity, right? And what you usually do in the standard model is do your rotations going from your weak eigenstate basis to your mass eigenstate basis. So those are the typical sort of rotations you do on the down, the left and right-handed up and down quarks of the standard model. So that allows you to define what your Yukawa matrices are, and all is good, and that also effectively defines the ZKM matrix. So now think about the case where the vector quarks are no longer decoupled and are also there, and you just do a rotation just like that going from this initial basis to this prime basis for the vector quarks. Now for the vector quarks, that rotation is just a rotation in field space. No, there's no eigenstate for the primes basis for the vector quarks. No interaction picks an eigenstate basis for them. So what's really nice about these guys is, and this is how the symmetry in the end of the day makes it very predictive so you can exactly solve the model, is you can just choose those rotations on the vector quarks. Now, when you write down the mass spectrum in this prime basis in the standard model, that would be mass diagonal. But there's still mixing between the standard model quarks and the vector quarks. So that's not mass diagonal in models of this form. This is what your mass matrix looks like. So you still need to do further rotations to make this thing mass diagonal. And what's nice is you know these kappas, because of minimal flare violation, are diagonal matrices or they're proportional to the standard model Yukawa matrices. And you know how the rotations on the standard model quarks define the CKM and define the Yukawa matrices. And you're allowed to choose the rotations on the vector quarks because you're just rotating those fields from one basis to another, and nothing picks an eigenstate basis. So you can actually exactly write down what the mass is, that mass matrix is. You don't have to make any further assumptions. And you can just, you'll have it in terms of just the Yukawa matrices, as you knew it kind of had to be because it's no flare violation. It's the only thing breaking the symmetry. And then you can just solve directly, and you just do that. We did that for all the models, five in the down sector, five in the up sector. And you can just look at what the mixing angles are and what the mass spectrum is. You can just analytically just figure out what they are. And so the mixing, the small parameter in the mixing is, of course, you knew it had to be proportional to Yukawa because that was breaking symmetry, and it has the ratio of the mass scales that appeared in the Lagrangian. And because you know what the mixing is, that allows you to basically figure out which models actually work. And what their mass spectrum in is also tells you which models actually work. So that's kind of nice. That's the way, you know, in the details of how this symmetry is predictive. So one of the problems with vector quarks that can mix with the standard model is that you could just choose the mixing angles to be whatever you want. It was, you know, you had lots of parameters to choose. But this symmetry, as symmetries always are, is predictive and restrictive. And it actually tells you what the mass spectrum and the mixing is. So we went a little crazy on the phenomenological constraints on this. I'm not going to go through them all. I'm just going to summarize them here. At the end of the day, the reason that the one particular model works in each case is because of the small corrections that it induces to the W and Z coupling of the standard model quarks. And that's just shown here. So the effective shift in the Z coupling is just proportional to the small Yukawas. And there's also a shift in the W coupling due to mixing. That can be problematic in some of those other models. which is what makes them flavor unnatural. But this one actually has another nice feature, which is that it's a diagonal shift from what you mean by the CKM matrix. So what you would have effectively measured is on the left-hand side of this equation here, between using the standard model quarks. And that would be related to the standard model CKM. By standard model CKM, I mean that would be what it would be in the decoupling limit of the vector quarks. Then you get this small diagonal shift due to mixing because of the vector quarks. So the CKM would be non-unitary, just the three-generation CKM would be non-unitary. But that is a diagonal shift, and so it works out, at the end of the day, if you go through some math, you'll find that there's contributions due to non-unitarity of the CKM matrix to meson-mixing observables. They're proportional to the square of the effective CKM, and they're sensitive to the off-diagonal square of the CKM. And this contribution, because it's a unitary, it's an effect on a unitary matrix which is diagonal in the first place, ends up giving a zero contribution of that form. So it just kind of, again, that came from the representation content of the theory of the group theory, kind of dictated how the symmetry breaking would go, and it dictates that this actually works really well. So that's kind of a nice and cute feature. And so at the end of the day, we did all these constraints, and I'm just showing here the ones that actually are the most interesting. So for the one model that works in the down sector and the one model that works in the up sector, we did, of course, zeta BB bar and RB constraints on those. This is just the translating the Tevatron direct search bound for heavy quarks, for heavy down-type quarks, and for heavy up-type quarks. We did electric precision data fits on these, and we did beta S gamma, and also K-on mixing also constrains this one as well. And so this is the sort of parameter space that you guys can probe and look for in direct collider searches. But you notice even the models that work well are already pretty darn constrained just from other precision measurements from other searches. So let me just show you what I mean by that. So this is just for 7TV, the total production cross-section contours in the remaining parameter space that isn't already constrained phenomenologically for these models that work really well. I mean, if I was to show you the plots of the models that don't work well, you'd be kind of scared because, you know, it's a really bad situation, very, very small cross-sections. You wouldn't, you know, it's a very, very constrained situation. These are the ones that are the least constrained because of their symmetry structure, but even still, it's a pretty constrained picture. So what's shown here are the total production cross-sections for these using next leading order analytic QCD results with QQ bar, blue glue, and Q glue initial states all added together. And this is for 7TV. So you can see for picobarn level cross-sections, you're already down in this rather constrained region of parameter space. And this is, of course, how the production cross-sections fall with mass for 7, 10, and 14 TeV. So this was, again, using analytic next leading order QCD. Mitov has a very nice paper on this that we were able to modify to use. He wasn't doing vector quarks, but we were able to modify it to get this analytic production using next to leading order, MSTW, PDFs, and for loop running. And so you can see how the cross-section goes up if you guys go to 10 and 14 TeV, the same production contours. These masses correspond just to the down case. They don't correspond to the up case. You can see how the production contours go up as you go up in energy. So you gain quite a bit. But even still, I mean, the sort of things that you could find in the next couple years, just because of event rate limitations, would have to really have really be consistent with these constraints, hopefully for a good reason, like a symmetry reason, if these models were to exist and be part of a sector like this. So are there any questions on that? Is that clear? They usually decay through producing a W in the standard model quark. Then the W or Z give you leptons. That's how they search for these things. So there's standard model searches. So there's not standard model. There's standard searches of the Tevatron. And you can just, it'll be the same deal. What's different here is it'll tell you basically when it goes from one quark species to another quark species, it'll tell you basically what the coupling is, going between different generations and such. But, you know, Bob also showed in the morning another search path using, you know, jet mass. But this is what they do, and this is how they, this is the way they basically decay, the way they find it. You can do either one, big search as well. So vector quarks are fine. That's the story. They're already constrained quite a bit. But there are these kind of nice minimal flare violating models that actually work and could be part of some sector. And there would be a good reason why we hadn't seen it in other precision tests and other flavor tests so far, because it would be dictated by the symmetry. So let me finish up by talking about
another model that Mark and I did a couple months ago. So there's multiple talks on just this slide. So I'm just going to basically breeze through this as motivation for writing down the model we wrote down. And I would say that at this point in time, there's only a hint. I wouldn't even use the word evidence, but they use the word evidence. But I would say there's a hint for possibly a phase beyond the standard model, a CP violating phase beyond the standard model, starting to emerge out of a number of observables in the B sector. It's none of it rises to the level of phi sigma. This one just appeared this year, and it's caused a great deal of excitement. And it's only 3.2 sigma. There are other anomalies that have been around for a while. There are 2 and 3 sigma. But what's interesting is that there's a pattern of anomalies that could all be explained nicely by there being a new phase that was starting to show up and causing some inconsistencies in these measurements. Let me try and explain that a little bit for just as motivation for going on to doing the model building. It's because, you know, you might be thinking at this point, well, fine, you're going to be consistent with precision measurements, but can you actually explain something? Can you actually go along and use this sort of thinking to actually write down a model which actually does the job for something, explain some anomaly? Here's an example of how you can do that and how this sort of thinking lets you write down what I think are really simple, really basic models that actually do the job. So what they're actually measuring is they're producing at the Tevatron EV bar, both S and D. There's oscillations going on before they decay, and sometimes they decay and give you 2 muons of like sign. They count the number of times once they do cut on muons when they're both positive, subtract them when they're both negative, and normalize it. And they get a number of events like that, which is far in excess of what the standard model prediction is. It's 3.2 sigma above the standard model prediction, or if you want to think of it another way, it's a factor of 42 above the standard model prediction. It's a pretty big signature. But it's only 3.2 sigma. But anyways, and so they've done joint fits. This is in their paper. And they actually also plot some other decays. So if there was a new phase in new CP violating phase in B physics, it would show up in lots of observables. So they actually plot some other measurements that would be sensitive to this phase here. And they say this is consistent with this sort of shift. And it is consistent with this sort of shift. But the errors are so big on this, this doesn't really add evidence to there being something beyond the standard model. But what is interesting and is more strong than these two observables shown here is that there's these correlated deviations like beta tau nu and long-standing consistency issues in penguin extractions of sine 2 beta. People have been saying this for years. And all of those could be explained if there was a new CP violating phase affecting these measurements. And it's kind of interesting that the sort of same sort of sign for the phase for beta tau nu to be explained in its anomaly from the standard model fit prediction is actually consistent with the sort of phase that they would be picking up here and seems to explain these measurements. So it's only a hint, but there's some hint in the data that maybe there's something beyond the standard model in terms of CP violation, which is good because we know we need more CP violation to exist. But nevertheless, let's just take it as a hint and let's just run with it and show how this sort of model building, this sort of approach can let you write down the field content that does the job pretty easily. So we're going to take the results of the CKM Fitter group. They did this global fit on this stuff, and they say there's a global 3 sigma anomaly putting a bunch of those observables together. And what they find is they shift. So they want it to be an effect on new CP violating phase and meson mixing. There's various arguments for that to be the case. But let's just go with that. Let's say you fit the data saying that it's a new phase in B sub S and B sub D mixing. This is how they do the fit. They basically shift the standard model prediction. They get these two parameters, and the fit results are given there in the red box. So it's a pretty big phase. It's pretty small, a pretty small correction, but it's a pretty big phase. So it's such a big thing, it's factor 42 of the standard model prediction number, that it seems like it would likely come from a tree-level exchange. Let's just start with the simplest sort of thing. You're starting with two spin 1/2 particles. It's a tree-level thing you're making, so you can have spin 0 or spin 1. We actually model built the hell out of this. We tried to do spin 1. We have tons of models. I'm just going to show you the best ones. They're the only ones in the paper. And it seems after doing all that, that scalar exchange is a good bet. And I think you'll see that it just does the job very simply. So what you have is the standard model contribution to meson mixing with its CKM factors. And then you have this new physics contribution, this operator, which also has the CKM factors. And It has a Wilson coefficient on a mass scale. At the end of the day, if you work it out, you can just show that these parameters, which they've done this fit for, would be related to this new physics Wilson coefficient and mass scale by this formula. The eta prime and eta here are just the running factors. They're like 1.4, 1.2, I think. So people have done fits to this, and the fits say that this signature that they were able to measure, not surprisingly, has to have a low mass scale. And this is a fit by Zoltan and friends in the middle clear violating framework. And so the mass scale would be, for this operator, about 13 TeV, order one stuff, times the VU calo, which is a very small number. That brings it down to a couple hundred GeV. So if it's a couple hundred GeV and it hasn't shown up in other measurements, it has to, other flavor observables systematically screwing things up. It basically has to sit within the middle clear violating framework. For example, kaon mixing, you would immediately worry about. And if you didn't have the CKM suppression and it was a scalar exchange, kaon mixing, you would almost certainly be wrong. So is there a simple minimal clear violating way that this could come about? There is. So as I said, we built a lot of models to do this. And at the end of the day, the simplest way this can come about is, I think, just a two scalar doublet model. With minimal flare violations. So you have one scalar that's going to be the Higgs, one scalar that's going to be the a second scalar doublet. We'll call it S, the second one. And you remember minimal flare violation says you write down something that has the flavor symmetry breaking structure of the standard model repeated. So though the ukawas of the second scalar doublet S, we know has to be proportional to the standard model up and down ukawas. The up has to be proportional to the up, down has to be proportional to the down. It tells you it has to be proportional for that symmetry breaking structure, but it doesn't tell you the proportionality constant. So there's these unknown A to U's and A to D's, A to U prime, A to D prime. So as you do this expansion, you can always write down more and more terms like this. That's what this expansion is about. So you have the second scalar doublet, which couples in this way and is consistent with minimal flare violation. And we decompose it as shown. And really, at the end of the day, this sort of effect can be coming about just from the exchange of the neutral scalars, and more importantly, the mass splitting of the neutral scalars. I'm just going to show you the results when you just do the simplest thing. There's actually other parameters in the potential which cause these not to be mass eigenstates. So we did the approximation where we set those other effects to zero. I think Jim will talk about when they're not set to zero. But this is just the simplest way it's come about. It's the basic physics. You exchange two neutral scalars. If they were the same mass, you would not get a Wilson coefficient. But the mass splitting, which comes from the potential, causes these contributions to give you a Wilson coefficient. And because this is an unknown proportionality constant, it's an order one number, it could be complex. It's just the square that appears there. It's not the absolute square. So that can give you the phase that would be required if this was reality. And so you can see it's mass to the fourth because it's coming from the mass splitting. So that's really damn simple how it could happen, how it could be the case. Damn simple is usually good. So, but there are phenomenological issues here. So let me just talk about some of them, and then how minimal flare violation can solve those two. It can do everything. So one thing is you want to avoid a light neutral state. So this whole thing is running off of the mass splitting of these neutral scalars that are being exchanged. By the way, they can do flavor change. That's why it's an A to D prime here, because of the CKM factors that come out of there. That's why it's not proportional to the leading guy here. You get the two, and that's what also dictates that when you take this model and predict the effect on kaon mixing, it's small enough so that it's okay, because it again reproduces the CKM suppression structure for the dimension six operators as you expect, because it's a minimal flare violation. So anyways, this mass splitting is how this whole effect is running off of, and that's a mass splitting for things that I told you when they do these fits are a couple hundred GeV, and that mass splitting is giving you a V squared sort of mass splitting, so that's kind of dangerous. You'd expect one of these states to be light, one of them to be heavy, and that is the case. So that's just being shown here is the mass splitting of SR and SI when you have two different values of lambda 1. The dashed is SI and the solid is SR for these two different values. And so you can see if you didn't have any sort of slightly greater than 1 normalization factor, you would have a light neutral state, which would be a little problematic for phenomenology. It's actually not directly ruled out, because at left these things would be produced in pairs. There'd be an SR and an SI. If SR was heavy enough, you could still have a light one, but then, if the Z could decay into it, it's just problematic to have it be so light. So it's just to say that it's preferred for this A to D prime to be a little greater than 1, say 2, 4, 5, something like that. So the mass scale is a little bit higher, and you can still have the effect. So that's an issue, but it's easily overcome in that way. There is a more serious issue. So if this is wrong, this is probably the reason it's wrong. So what is the issue? So you have a new CP violating phase. We have all sorts of ways we've been looking for CP violation. For example, we've been measuring EDMs for a long time. We've been measuring the neutron EDM. So if you have this charge scalar and it carries a phase, its couplings carry a phase, then it can induce a neutron EDM that's actually bigger than the experimental bound. So how does that come about? What's the largest contribution? What's the most dangerous thing here? So you just have this loop, this one loop diagram with a charge scalar. You have a top, throw off a gluon. So then, of course, you can have an effective one-loop operator for the B quark coupling to the gluon. That operator can be inserted in a three-gluon diagram. That's effectively a two-loop effect, but it's still too big. You integrate out the B quark, as far as the neutron is concerned, and you get Weinberg's CP-violating three-gluon operator in here. And the Wilson coefficient of this operator is given here, and you can see that it has all of these cross terms that come about from the expansion. See, all those terms are coming about from the expansion and the cross terms from the different eucalypts. So you get all the possible cross terms. And the imaginary part of all those possible cross terms, and those are just order one numbers, you don't know them, they're the normalization constants. They could be complex, so there could be an imaginary part there. And all of those guys, a lot of those guys, give contributions that are just way too big, factor 10, factor 20 too big for the neutron EDM. If you just work it out for the mass scales we're talking about of a couple hundred GeV, that's just the situation. Now, that being the situation is a statement based upon your estimate of the matrix element of this operator for the neutron. That's tough, but we use naive dimensional analysis to do that. You can have other estimates that are lower by a factor of 10 or so, but it's still problematic, I think. It's fair to say. So remember, I also said you don't want a light neutral state, so you wanted this coupling to be big. So it's even worse, right? So you're making that number like 4, 3 or 4, 5, and that's just a bad situation. So it's bigger by a factor of 10, 20 than the experimental bound. So it seems like there would be this peculiar sort of pattern of couplings. You want an enhanced coupling to the down sector, a suppressed coupling to the up sector if this was the case. Now, it could just also be done by tuning. I mean, this isn't like hierarchy problem tuning. I mean, this is, you know, factors of 10, factors of 100, which just could be the case. But, it's all about symmetry, and it would be nice if there was a nice symmetry that was going to do the job. And it would be really nice, this thing's motivated by middle flare violation, if something in middle flare violation was telling you that that had to be the case. Can that be the case? The answer is yes. So here's a very simple extension of that model, which would naturally have cohomological couplings, would still give the signal in a very simple way, just coming from the mass splitting of these tree-level diagrams, but it would also have the coupling suppressed in the same way. It just kind of gives you an idea of middle flare violating thinking. Being willing to have things transform out of the flavor group can be a good thing. So if this second scalar doublet S was just an 8 under the down flavor group, we can choose to represent it with the Gell-Mann matrices. And then if you just think about it for a moment, you just know you need to soak up all the indices for it to couple to the up quarks. You need to insert two down quarks. The group theory is just telling you that's the case. Whereas the coupling in the down quark sector would not be suppressed. So in the up quark sector, you would get your order one number multiplying two very small down eucalypts. That just be the way it is because of the symmetry structure of the theory. And then it would naturally work with this phenomenology while still giving this very simple effect in this very simple way from just tree-level exchange of these scalars. And that, in this case, the Wilson coefficient is given here. The only difference is just, when you do the group theory, that's why you get a factor of 6 and such. So, minimal flare violation. Is there anything it can't do? Anyways, so let me just summarize and finish up. So, considering LHC's discovery reach, anything you guys find, it's a trivial statement, but it's very true, actually very important, is going to be consistent with flavor constraints. And those are strong constraints. And there's not just one measurement there. There's a pattern. There's a ton of measurements there, which is telling us something very non-trivial. I think that might mean something And I think it might translate into a symmetry which dictates the Lagrangians we should be writing down. That could be the case. And so people usually call this the new physics flavor problem. It's not a problem, it's an opportunity. It's a new physics flavor opportunity to think of, well, look, it's telling us that maybe there's a symmetry like this. Maybe we should just be doing the simplest thing, writing down field content and studying what we can actually even write down. So it is a great opportunity because it means you guys can actually find things, and it'll be some sort of natural reason why we haven't discovered it in these other measurements. Again, it will be the symmetry doing it. So it does the job of giving you the right standard model flavor violation pattern in a lot of cases, although not all cases. The vector quarks were a nice example because they made you realize, I hope, that you know this is a good starting point, but there still can be issues. So you'll even have a more restrictive set of things to think about and look for if there was a sector like this around. But it's being classified, field content like this, by myself and others. And we're just exploring basically what we can write down. It's been 0 and spin 1/2. And yet, it's not just that you're just not going to be ruled out by precision tests for a lot of the models you write down. It also can do things like it allows new CP-violating flavor universal phases. And that's good because it seems like there may be a hint starting to emerge that there may be CP violation beyond the standard model possibly starting to show up, although it's only a hint. And I think it just manifestly leads you to think in the right way so that you can write down models that just work and do the job very simply. And then when you go and check things like K-on mixing, which kill most models which want to do something like that, it will actually work correctly because of the symmetry structure you built into the theory from the start. Put another way, say you guys find a resonance, say you guys find something, at say it looks like its mass scale is around a TeV, the immediate question that many of us are going to ask is, what the hell? How could that possibly be the case, considering flavor constraint? And so starting with the sort of field content and model building that kind of works in the first place is a good starting point to try and figure out what you guys are actually seeing. And it's also good for you because you might find some of this stuff, and it's good to know how to look for it and confirm it if it's actually there, because it gives you very predictive patterns of couplings and mass spectra, as I try to emphasize. So that's it.